When I think about the key elements of 9 to 5, or the way we did our work, I think of that as including the way we did the organizing, the importance of campaigns in structuring struggles, the importance of education, both for our members and also for ourselves, the culture that we created, and then lastly, how we operated as a staff. And so I just wanted to say a little bit about that, that there aren't that many workplaces, I think, that functioned as well as ours. And I hope I don't have rose-colored glasses on about this, but I think that we really did foster and create a staff that created it had high expectations of ourselves and each other, that an environment in which we all felt entitled to enjoy and own the victory, and all equally were responsible for failures. There was rarely scapegoating, and there really wasn't very much competition. You know, that I think it's emerged in a number of the other interviews that otherwise I would feel like, oh, is that really right, or is that just, you know, my view, because, you know, I was the director, so it's easy for me to feel like, oh, everything worked so well, but and there was no competition. But that is what we are hearing from other people in the interviews, and that is so gratifying, that people all felt like, I have enough room to do whatever I want here, to, you know, operate at my highest possible level. And that is what we wanted from each other, because we were all in this together building a movement, and we were not in it to outdo one another. And that makes me feel great. You know, I just feel like we really built something where people felt like they could throw themselves into it, be creative, and be collective about it. You know, there was this kind of collective approach, and at the same time, accountability. You know, that this was not just like a feel-good consensus operation. We believed in accountability, that we were there to do a job, that we were responsible to each other and to the people we were organizing and to the workers whose dues we were spending by even just being on staff. We started staff evaluations early, you know, in the early days of 9 to 5, the association. We wrote up these staff evaluations, and we evaluated the staff, and the staff evaluated the supervisors, and we just took it all very seriously, and I hope created a sense that we were there to do a job, you could get the resources you needed to do your job well, that there were high expectations for the work, that we were working for a cause higher than our own careers. Very few people came in as careerists. And that it could be fun, you know, that you were expected to, you know, have your spirit, you know, satisfied as well. And that kind of collaborative work, the combination of a collaborative work, a lot of teamwork, and accountability was what I tried to take with me everywhere I went, from the beginning of 9 to 5 into the union, into the Women's Bureau, and then to the NFL-CIO. And I think it's really had good results just every place I've been. And it's just been wonderful to see it emerge in so many different ways in the stories that have been told, the 9 to 5 Legacy Project.
Okay, well, after you left the Women's Bureau of the Department of Labor, you went back into AFL-CIO. Tell us a little bit about the job you took on there.
While I was at the Department of Labor, there was a huge fight brewing inside the labor movement. It really came to a head after the Democrats lost the Congress in 1994. And finally, the leaders in the labor movement decided that they had to take on Lane Kirkland, who was the president of the FL-CIO, because the labor movement was in free fall and he was the wrong leader. And so it was John Sweeney, who'd been the president of the SEIU when I had been there those years, who became the person who ran against Kirkland, and ultimately Tom Donahue, who was named by Kirkland to take his place, was there for a heartbeat. But and I remember being on the subway on my way into work to the Department of Labor one morning and reading the newspaper, and the headline was something like, "Labor leader says unions are a disaster," or something like that. And I thought, wow, this is the greatest news I've heard in years. But because what it meant was that, you know, people in the union movement were willing to say that the emperor had no clothes, and it was the first glimmer of a new day in the labor movement on a big enough scale that would make a change. And then John Sweeney won, and to me it seemed much more interesting to go back to building power instead of just levering the power of government, instead actually go back into the labor movement to build power for workers. So I went into the AFL-CIO under John Sweeney and created the Working Women's Department. There had never been a women's department there. And, you know, we had a lot of fun. We did great work. We had these unbelievable conferences that were, to this day, people, these were 5 years ago and 7 years ago, and people still come up to me and say, that was the most exhilarating thing I've ever been to. And, you know, this sense of building power in women across unions. But ultimately, it was actually too threatening to the institutions, the different affiliates. You know, the affiliates don't want their women members going to somebody else's conference and getting turned on. They want them to go to that affiliate's conference and think that that male president is who they should love. And that the problems with doing women's work from day one, which is that it's always marginalized, ultimately still were a factor at the AFL-CIO. So that when there was an internal crisis around funding and unions putting pressure on Sweeney to, you know, throw overboard whole parts of his program, they eliminated the women's department. So it was, and I had to make this decision about what I would do, and I decided that the most important thing to me was to do what I could to fight for the program, but also to understand the rules of my institution, which are, you know, I worked for John Sweeney, and I wasn't going to organize against him. It'd be wholly inappropriate. I wasn't a member or a leader of a union. And that was the decision he had made. And I could decide then whether I wanted to stay, whether there was personal dignity for me in staying or not. And it was actually that a woman friend at the AFL-CIO, Arlene Holt, who was an assistant to the president, who figured out how to make space for me to do the kind of work that I was good at. And so I also became an assistant to the president, which at that time was really kind of getting kicked upstairs. That's where the failures went before they figured out how to boot them out, right? And but I ended up being able to run these big campaigns around, first around white-collar workers who were losing their jobs around these corporate scandals, Enron and WorldCom, and then ultimately into helping to build this big new organization, which is so completely thrilling, called Working America, which I think of now as kind of like 9 to 5 with men and resources. You know, in 3 years, we've, you know, built a membership of 1.5 million people, these working class moderates who live in the suburbs and up big cities. And, you know, going again, the idea is we go to where workers are in their heads and build organization from there out, as opposed to saying, well, here's what a union is, so figure out how you fit into our box and then maybe we'll let you in on the game.
And how do you approach these folks around the country to join Working America?
Most of it's done through another old tactic, which is door-to-door canvassing. So we send organizers out into communities who talk to people at their homes, working people who don't have a union, about good jobs and a just economy. And usually it's around specific issues like healthcare, retirement, security. And get people to identify, you know, we figure out who identifies basically with those goals and values. And two out of three people we talk to do identify with it and sign up and become members, and then we engage them in activity and so on. Mm-hmm. What was, so that's been great. It's been like one of the most exciting work I've done in my whole life, which is really cool to, at my age at 56, being able to do something brand new that's, you know, wonderful. And a big success, and exercises real power.
Some acknowledgement now in AFL-CIO about it being an effective strategy to mobilize power.
Right. That you could. Right. This old idea that you can that you start with where people are, and then figure out how to build organization around that or movement around that, and then figure out your kind of your power strategy based on how people are willing to move, as opposed to starting with only with where power is, and then figuring out how you can shuttle people into that equation. So it's been exhilarating and just a lot of fun. But what was interesting to me at the time that they deep six the working women's department was, I was devastated by it. I felt like a personal failure. I felt like my life's work had just gone down the drain, that, you know, that my commitment to trying to build women's organization within the labor movement had utterly failed. And so I turned to Millie Jeffrey, who had been at the time, I don't know, was in her 80s or something, and who had been a real a leader in the labor movement. She'd been in the UAW, and she'd been both a civil rights activist in the UAW, and, you know, legislative. And also, she was just kind, and she was not petty. You know, she was, as she came to one of these women's conferences, the first one that we ran in 1997, and I didn't really even hardly know her then, but she came up to me and she said, "Karen, this is so exciting. I'm so thrilled that you're doing this." And I hate to say it, very few older women in the labor movement were generous in that way.
Toward these new programs you were involved in.
Yeah. They just didn't have that kind of generous spirit. And I really loved that about Millie. And so when I was in my moment of despair, I went to Millie thinking, you know, well, she's had all this experience. She's had all these ups and downs in the labor movement and work that she did afterwards. And so I did meet with her, and I told her my tale of woe and everything. And I expected her to say, "Yes, that's terrible. Here's how you need to fight it," and, you know, so on and so forth. And instead she said, "Well, you know, you'll probably just have to figure out some other way to approach the issues in a different way, or find other work that you find meaningful." And I remember being so deflated afterwards, thinking, well, that wasn't what I was looking for at all. But then, you know, a year or something later, realizing how right she was, and in a way it helps me shape my view of what the 9-to-5 legacy is, at least to me. And for my work, it's always been trying to think about, and not just for me, but from my own perspective, to think about movement, organization, and consciousness. And those are all different, and you make advances generally in one area and not in the other, certainly not all three at the same time. But you know, and it's the interplay and the dialectic among those things that really is what advances over time. And but also understanding that especially consciousness is not linear. You know, it's not, it doesn't advance it goes back and forth. And, you know, for example, having just lived in the last 10 years, we can all testify to that. And for me to think about the legacy, I realized that I had been much more wedded to the organization part of that. And that partly because, you know, that's got your name attached to it. And, you know, well, did the name of your organization make it through into the history books or not? And I realize now that that may be the least important of the things over time. And, it's more how you use the interplay of movement, organization, and consciousness that does hopefully in some way move society forward over time, or at least improve society in the time in which you live. That, and I hope that, and I do believe that 95 is has an important legacy in that respect.
I just thought of another question, though, from sort of the legacy and history point of view. Is this the first time the AFL-CIO has ever had a kind of organization where they invite, you know, people outside of a collective bargaining situation to affiliate with a branch kind of the AFL-CIO?
It's certainly never been done on this scale or in this way. Many unions start this way. They, you know, the history of unionization often is in these voluntary associations and, you know, don't even necessarily have anything to do with the workplace. Certainly there was a whole creativity around organizing in the 30s that was worker-based but had a community expression to it. So there's a, you know, there are historical antecedents to this. But in the last 40 years or 50 years, you saw everything about organizing being funneled into ever narrow definitions of collective bargaining. That if, where unions, without almost even noticing, had the room in which they could operate becoming ever more narrow decade after decade. And at the same time, you had a decision-making structure within the AFL-CIO that is based on the affiliated unions. And so no individual union had an interest or would personally benefit from an additional organization being created. And so it required affiliated organizations taking a bigger view, or at least us creating the space that allowed us to build to prove the case. And then bring along the affiliates. But there had been just tremendous resistance for 30 years for creating an associate membership directly affiliated with the AFL-CIO. It had been blocked. And we just finally figured out the right ways to get past that, build a model that was so unarguably successful that we then began to gain the support much more broadly.
Yeah, it seems to me you could perhaps say that the legacy is not only the vision that you just articulated of the interplay between organizing, movement, and consciousness, but the actual substantial 1.5 million people in working America are a legacy.
Right, 95 with men and resources.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Karen.
Thanks.
That was great.